Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for you today, and all of it's brought to you by Simply Safe Home Security. Right now, Simply Safe Home Security, you can buy their brand new system for $100 off the regular price, simplysafe.com/ricochet. And Jim, Fridays used to be a quiet time in Washington. You might get some sort of dump of information that an administration finds slightly embarrassing and hopes it gets ignored over the weekend. And by the time Monday rolls around, people will have either forgotten about it or something else will have happened by then. That doesn't happen anymore. It doesn't even come close to happening anymore. Late Friday afternoon, we found out that White House Chief of Staff Ryan Priebus had actually resigned on Thursday. This had been in the works for some time. In subsequent interviews, he mentioned that the incoming Chief of Staff, General John Kelly, formerly the Homeland Security Secretary, he and Priebus had been in talks for the past couple of weeks, so this was a smooth transition. This had been known to be coming. So, Jim, in an atmosphere that at least from the outside appears to be chaotic, the addition of General Kelly to the inner circle at the White House seems like a good idea to establish some order and discipline and hopefully some message discipline as well. A little bit worried about what might happen at Homeland Security because by all accounts he was doing a fantastic job there. So hopefully there's a good pick to replace him. I know you and I have talked before about whether Priebus was the problem. At this point, what's done is done. And hopefully, if anybody can get this ship headed in the right direction, in a cohesive direction, it's General Kelly.
And let's emphasize for all of our listeners, this is a family podcast. So, Greg, we're hoping he gets the ship with a P headed in the right direction, not the word that it may have sounded like. And some folks might say might be equally applicable here. Look, there are conservatives I know and respect who think that Reince Priebus was the problem. I remain unconvinced of that, but they said they really suspected him of being a leaker or that the communication staff was loyal to him and they were trying to protect his reputation and that, you know, look, I think this all starts from the top. I think a lot of this has to do with Trump's personality, his idea of what a manager is supposed to do, his idea, his idiosyncrasies, his temptation to vent on Twitter. All presidents vent like Nixon and Clinton and all that stuff. It's just they don't usually do so in such a public manner. Lots of presidents have gotten very upset with their own staff. They just rarely do it, exposing it to the whole wide world. I think that's the bigger issue, causing the dissension in the ranks and the backstabbing and this Game of Thrones atmosphere in the White House. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it really was Reince Priebus not being a strong enough persona. John Kelly's been getting rave reviews. I happen to know some people at DHS. They were really sorry to see him go. You know, maybe John Kelly is enough of a commanding presence to get everybody's oars rowing in the same direction. Good luck, Mr. Kelly. If you can't do it, it's hard to believe that anybody else can. You do kind of wonder, though, looking at this White House staff. I mean, look, you've got Steve Bannon, Gary Cohn, Jared Ivanka, Kellyanne Conway, somebody like Stephen Miller, Mike Pence. I mean, there's a wide range of philosophies and ideas and agendas and priorities there. And there's always this impression that whoever speaks to the president last has the best chance of getting their way or will end up being the most persuasive voice. So everybody's very, very conscious of their place in the hierarchy, and everybody wants to be higher than someone else. And there seems to be this great rivalry we heard about. At first, it was Priebus versus Bannon, and then Priebus and Bannon were going to team up against Jared and all that kind of stuff. You just like to hear about a White House where everybody's focused on the same thing, which is helping enact the president's agenda. Hopefully, John Kelly is the guy who can do that. And I think that if 6 months from now we're in the exact same spot, then we will be able to conclude pretty definitively. No, the problem wasn't Reince Priebus. The problem is the president, and not even as strong a leader as John Kelly can, you know, bring discipline and structure to this White House. But maybe he will change things. And if so, then, yeah, the evidence will suggest that it was Reince's fault.
And as you pointed out at the start of the Morning Jolt today, Jim, if in fact he can succeed in this endeavor a few years from now, we'll have an interesting movie, perhaps starring John Cena, who is the WWE figure who once starred in a movie called The Marine. And given that imagery, as a former wrestling fan myself, you know, there are times when certain wrestlers get enough into a frenzy that they can just clear the ring. So I can just imagine this metaphorical political battle royale with all the figures you just mentioned. And then Kelly comes diving down the ramp, knocks everybody out of the ring, not saying he would fire them all, but let them all know that business as usual is not going to be happening at this White House.
If 2 or 3 months from now, things for the White House are going significantly better, you know his nickname is going to end up being Kindergarten Cop. So here's hoping.
Oh, man. All right, let's move on to the Bad Martini now. And this is a follow-up to our first Bad Martini on Friday. And that was when three Republicans banded with all 48 Democrats to sink the skinny repeal and basically killing any reasonable chance for a major legislative effort to do something about Obamacare. As we pointed out, it was basically focused on repealing the individual mandate, the employer mandate, the medical device tax. It would have expanded opportunities for folks to contribute to their health savings accounts. And as advocates for that legislation pointed out, it really would have triggered another Voterama. So in a sense, even though it wasn't officially a motion to proceed, in some ways it actually was. So we talked a lot about John McCain and his dramatics on early Friday morning. Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski were the others. So let's talk a little bit about Lisa Murkowski. Lisa Murkowski, of course, is an Alaska senator. She was appointed by her father to replace himself in the U.S. Senate. She then was able to win subsequent reelection efforts, although she did lose a primary in 2010, but then won as a write-in. Then she won pretty easily in 2016. Anyway, she was one of the three no votes on last early Friday morning. And then after the vote, I think this is Carrie Pickett of the Daily Caller. She certainly wrote the story on this. But this is the Daily Caller confronting Lisa Murkowski about her previous statements in wanting to repeal Obamacare and previous votes, mind you, and her decision not to move forward late last week.
Senator Murkowski, you've been criticized for being very critical of the ACA and campaigning against it during your last election. And essentially, there have been a lot of flashback pieces on it. Can you respond to the criticism of being previously against it and now voting essentially against the skinny repeal of it?
Yeah. Why was voting no today?
Why is that exactly?
I am really very tired. And so you're asking for a very thoughtful response. And I actually appreciate your question. But rather than respond to each and every individual request with all of these cameras around me,
go ahead and call
I'm going to take a pass.
Well, a senator who's been there for over 10 years is now suddenly intimidated by all the cameras, and it's late, Jim. She's really tired. You know what we're really tired of? Republicans not doing what they promised to do on the campaign trail. So then on Friday afternoon, she sent out this mealy-mouthed statement saying she voted no on the health care proposal last night because both sides must do better on process and substance. The Affordable Care Act remains a flawed law that I'm committed to reforming with a structure that works better for all Americans. But to do that, the Senate must fully devote itself to an effort to improve the health care system in this country, reduce costs, increase access, and deliver the quality of care that our families want and deserve. She goes on to say that there's a lot of families in Alaska that have shared their frustrations, but she's not sure that this legislation would have solved those problems. And Jim, we agreed with that in some ways. This was not a final bill. This was an effort to get more amendments voted on and ultimately get to a conference. And who knows what we would have ended up with. And then you can make a final decision on whether it's good for your people. But this boilerplate statement after saying she had no good answer right after the vote ought to leave us scratching our heads even more.
Greg, I could give commentary on that, but I'm tired. And I'm not going to. Yeah, I guess I didn't know you could just take that as an out. Hope she's feeling well. Get better, Senator Murkowski. Not only get better in terms of health, but get better at your job. Because I'd like to put this to Murkowski and McCain and to John Kasich, who's certainly been noisy about this. They keep talking about what the goal they want to get to, but they never really give any good sense of how they want to get to that goal. We all want better choice, but we also want to keep Medicaid exactly the way it is. Okay, well, you're on Medicaid, you have very limited options because a lot of doctors don't take Medicaid. A lot of the finest clinic, the Mayo Clinic, they don't take Medicaid patients anymore because they don't like the reimbursement rates. They basically say, look, we take a loss on every patient. So we can, a lot of doctors will say, we'll do a few of them. we'll do as many as we can afford, but we just can't afford to do this because the government won't pay us enough. Now, the expense of Medicaid is already really high. It's already really expensive, at least from the point of view of the taxpayers. Do you want to raise the reimbursement rates so the doctors feel like they're getting a better deal and they more doctors are willing to take Medicaid patients? You can do that. It's going to cost more. The next thing is they always say, oh, we want to bring down premiums. Okay, how do you want to do that? Competition, they kind of get mealy-mouthed about, and they'll say, general company. They don't really say how they want to get to that competition. And one of the ways they say, we want to bring down prices, but we absolutely positively have to make sure we keep covering pre-existing conditions. Well, for the insurance company, this is a terrible deal because basically you can, if you're young and healthy, you don't have to get health insurance. And then you find out that you're sick, and then you go and you purchase health insurance. And you can't keep them off or you can't charge them more because it's a pre-existing condition. Well, gee, this is like asking the insurance company to place a bet that they've already lost, right? The insurance companies, the whole way the insurance company works is by spreading out the risk amongst lots of people. And in any given year, only a certain percentage are going to have a terrible car accident or fall off a ladder or, God forbid, get cancer or have some other serious health ailment that requires them to shell out a lot. And there's this denial of these facts. And there's this insistence that somehow if we just work together in a bipartisan way, we can reach that. Well, it's time to start pressing the Lisa Murkowskis and John McCain's and Susan Collins's of the world and say, all right, how do you want to get to it? Because at least on the Democratic side, a big chunk of it is, well, we got to help out these insurance companies. You go back and you sell that to your constituents. You tell them that the poor insurance companies are in deep trouble because the coverage is so expensive. And you know how much it feels like you're paying way too much in premiums? Well, you're not paying enough, so the government has to give them taxpayer money. Good luck with that. I know some people are saying Trump is demagoguery on this, but the whole point of Obamacare was to help out the insurance companies by making it legally required for everyone to purchase their product. No other company in America gets that kind of a benefit. This is like charging people for oxygen, right? The government will punish you if you do not buy this product with higher taxes. Car companies don't get that. Fruits and vegetable companies don't get that. Computer companies don't get that. Only health insurance companies get the government saying, we're going to make every single citizen purchase your product. And they say they still don't have enough money. So I'm of the mindset that we got to get away from the mandates. We got to get away from the requirements. We got to get away from all these things that making people do things. It's not going to be fun and games, and people are going to not like having the free market. Some people are going to have to pay more. But the more you remain in denial of this, you have this small caucus of Republican senators who just seem to think that just by happy, good feelings, you're going to be able to get to something. The sooner you acknowledge that you have a circumstance in which that there is no happy kumbaya end to the healthcare reform discussion, the better off we're going to be. And in fact, one of the reasons it makes it so hard to work this way is because there are lawmakers who keep insisting that just by being nice, somehow, some way, things will turn out just right. So anyway, that's where we are.
I stand ready to begin work with my colleagues, all of them, to reform healthcare in a more open process. Well, that solves it. Good for her. We were hoping that our healthcare would be secure. We were hoping that our wallets would be secure once Republicans got done dealing with this. We're hoping more of our liberty would be secure. Not going to happen, at least not in this Congress, it would appear. But that doesn't mean that your home can't be secure. A lot of us get excited for summer because it means going on vacation or spending long days at the beach, maybe even taking the kids to the amusement park. But you know what gets a burglar really excited for summer? Knowing that you're going to do all those things and leaving your house empty. Summer is prime time for burglary. Deion Sanders isn't their spokesman, but it is prime time for burglary. So now is the time to protect your home. For a limited time, you can take a whopping $100 off SimpliSafe's special summer package.
This is SimpliSafe's biggest ever summer sale. It has everything you need to protect your home, an arsenal of security sensors to secure each door and window. Your SimpliSafe system comes with a panic button, a blaring extra siren, and a wireless connection to authorities and police dispatch. Your family, your home, and everything in it will stay safe around the clock. With SimpliSafe, there are no long-term contracts, no installation costs, and no hidden fees. You just get 24/7 professional monitoring for just $14.99 a month.
This summer, see what SimpliSafe can do for your home. Get $100 off your summer security package at simplisafe.com/ricochet. Now, I've got good news and bad news on the timing here. The good news is this sale extends until July 31st. The bad news is today is July 31st, so you need to hurry. That's simplisafe.com/ricochet to get your $100 off. SIMPLISAFE.com/ricochet, simplysafe.com/ricochet for $100 off your home security system purchase. Jim, let's move on to the crazy martini now. And I believe, according to recent polls, a good chunk of the Democratic base doesn't really believe the results of the 2016 presidential race yet. But that hasn't stopped a Democrat from starting the wave of running for president in 2020. Yes, it's the summer of 2017. We're over a year away from the midterms, yet John Delaney, a Democratic congressman from Maryland's 6th Congressional District, says he is not running for re-election next year. He is throwing his hat into the ring for president of the United States. And Jim, you'll be pleased to know that this Democrat is different. Listen to some of this pablum and this boilerplate rhetoric here from the left. This is his op-ed July 28th in the Washington Post. The American people are far greater than the sum of our political parties. It's time for us to rise above our broken politics and renew the spirit that enabled us to achieve the seemingly impossible. This is why I am running for the Democratic nomination for president of the United States. Our government is hamstrung by excessive partisanship. We are letting critical opportunities to improve the country pass us by, and we are not even talking about the most important thing, the future. His focus, Jim, not like those other guys, his focus is on preparing our country for the future. He does spend a paragraph talking a little bit about what he would prioritize, but it's still in this glossy language. He says we need new infrastructure, and he would use a new bipartisan approach to infrastructure and international tax reform. He says we need to be smarter. We haven't heard that before. Fueled by more investment in science, education, and research. Here's my personal favorite. We need to encourage a more just and inclusive form of capitalism. That's not usually how capitalism works. It kind of runs on its own, and you meet the market where it is. We also need to strengthen our safety net programs and create a new social contract. And we need to take affirmative steps to reduce our security, fiscal, and climate risks. So, Jim, clearly he's breaking the mold here.
Bingo! I'm sorry, Greg. While you were talking, I had in one row infrastructure, opportunity, excessive partisanship, future, and inclusive. Future is the center square. Every presidential candidate's going to get that one. So they kind of give you that one. But then I win something, right? I get a home copy of the DVD series, DVD series of Mulaney's sitcom. It was great. I remember it was a good. Which guy is it? Wait, who? Delaney? It's not Mulaney. Oh, bummer. I mean, John Delaney's running for president to the resounding cries of who?
Right.
I'm fairly certain it's one of the Republican PACs. Like they issued a one word statement. Who? I mean, you and I follow politics. I think I might have heard his name once before. Right. He's from, you know, this is the Western panhandle of Maryland. Roscoe Bartlett was a Republican, kind of a moderate Republican for a lot of years. He's been in the House 3 terms. Like you'd think we might have noticed him right now. Greg, this is the first man to run for president from the Witness Protection Program. And it's such, you know, generic, like this is the kind of strategy like for a thriller story about trying to assassinate a presidential candidate. They don't really want the presidential candidate to be anything distinctive, just kind of the generic presidential candidate. This is the sort of boilerplate speech that generic candidate is always giving. We're having a lot of well-justified laughter about this, but I think it's kind of a giant glaring warning sign for the Democrats who think, Trump is terrible. He's going to be so easy to beat in 2020. Well, look, first of all, it all depends on what the state of the country is. How's the economy doing? How do people, Americans, feel about the future? Have there been terrorist attacks? Has North Korea blown up? I mean, you know, there's just a lot of variables between now and then. But what we saw amongst the Republicans last cycle, which our listeners no doubt remember, Greg, is that we had two tiers of Republican candidates. There were so many of them, you literally could not fit them all on the same stage. And they had to have the undercard for Bobby Jindal being stuck in the lower tier. And then you had the higher tier ones and the A-team of seven or eight candidates and this great deal of competition of which one you were going to be in or something like that. Look, it's very conceivable that Democrats have 10 to 15 to 20 candidates this time in 2020. And man, oh, man, you know, that explains why John Delaney is jumping out and attempting to get attention now, because you hear talk about members of Congress running, mayors running, celebrities running. Trump opened the door and basically said to a lot of candidates, look, you know, or basically kind of said to the political world, no, you don't need to be a senator. No, you don't need to be a governor. You don't need to have served multiple terms. It's worth noting before you say, ah, isn't it terrible Trump did this? Look, before him, you know, Barack Obama had been a senator for 4 years, and he basically had been in the Senate for about 10 minutes. I'm sorry, 2 years before announcing he was running for president. Before then, George W. Bush had just been reelected as governor in 1998. It wasn't that long. In 1999, decided to run for president. So he was a marginally just barely two-term governor. There was a time, you know, where this was considered unthinkable. And now I think everybody and their brother is going to look at themselves in the mirror and say, oh, I see a president looking back at me. And even if I don't, I'll get a great book deal out of it, maybe a television contract, big speaking fees. I am a minor political celebrity. But let me tell you, running for president, that's a way to turn me into a bigger political celebrity. And I threw that accusation at a bunch of Republican candidates last time. I don't feel the least bit bad about that. I think when you look at what they've done since their short-lived and obvious, you know, unbelievable long-shot bids. In fact, I do believe Jim Gilmore is still running around the country, still running. I think no one now told him that the race is over. The governor is actually a really nice man. I feel bad for him, but you know. When you get like 6 votes in Iowa, I don't mean 6 precincts, I mean 6 votes, it's time to, you know, hang it up there. This is, you know, you saw Carly Fiorina coming out. I could see there's talk of business leaders coming out running for the Democratic nomination. You know, we're going to have crowds of candidates. And we look back on the old days of the snooty Washington elite journalists kind of weeding out candidates and not even giving them the time of day or any coverage because they were considered such a long shot. Greg, before the time this is done, we may miss those days. We may feel there was a real purpose to that filtering, is it kept the gadflies out. It kept the people who were just out for unrealistic chances and simply not really prepared for it. And you know, unless you're really itching to see John Mulaney, Delaney, like, doesn't it say something? You can't remember who this guy's name is. So anyway, good luck, Delaney.
Yeah. Good luck.
Dana Delaney.
Yeah. I looked him up a little bit. He's worth about $91 million. So a rich white guy is running for the Democratic presidential nomination. We'll see how that works out. And
good luck.
And you mentioned Roscoe Bartlett. He's literally living off the grid now in West Virginia somewhere with no contact with the rest of society, last I heard. And apparently John Delaney was doing it, just not intentionally.
Oh, what a start to the week, Greg.
Jim, it can only get better from here, hopefully. Talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And don't forget to visit our friends at Simply Safe Home Security. The sale ends tonight. SimplySafe.com/ricochet to get $100 off your new home security system. Tune in on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.